Good evening. I'm Elizabeth Davis, Executive Vice President and Provost at Baylor University. It's my pleasure to welcome those of you in our audience in historic Waco Hall and those joining us on C-SPAN to On Topic with President Ken Starr. Our On Topic events bring to Baylor individuals with significant perspectives on a variety of issues. Our desire is that the exchange between our president and world-renowned experts will stimulate dialogue on issues vital to us all. We're privileged tonight to welcome Dr. Oz Guinness. Dr. Guinness was born during World War II in China, where both his parents and grandparents were medical missionaries. And yes, his great-great-grandfather was Arthur Guinness, the famous Dublin brewer. Dr. Guinness experienced great sadness as a young boy. Two of his brothers and 5 million others died during a horrific 3-month-long famine in 1943. And a few years after the Chinese Revolution in 1949, Dr. Guinness, along with many other foreigners, was expelled from the country. After leaving China for Europe, he received his education in England. He holds a bachelor's degree from the University of London and a Doctor of Philosophy degree in the social sciences from Oriel College at Oxford. In 1984, Dr. Guinness came to the United States. He's been a guest scholar at the Woodrow Wilson Center for International Studies and at the Brookings Institution. In the late 1980s, he served as executive director of the Williamsburg Charter Foundation, and he was the lead author of the Williamsburg Charter, a document written to celebrate the bicentennial anniversary of the First Amendment. The Williamsburg Charter calls for a fresh consideration of religious liberty in our time. It was signed by former presidents Jimmy Carter and Gerald Ford, former chief justices William Rehnquist and Warren Burger, Coretta Scott King, and many others. In 1991, Dr. Guinness founded the Trinity Forum, a nonprofit organization that works to cultivate networks of leaders whose integrity and vision will renew culture and promote human freedom and flourishing. The Trinity Forum's programs offer context for leaders to consider together the great ideas that have shaped Western civilization and the faith that has animated its highest achievements. As the founding senior fellow of the Trinity Forum, he was a frequent speaker and seminar leader at political and business conferences in the United States and Europe. Dr. Guinness has written or edited 30 books, including most recently, The Global Public Square, Religious Freedom and the Making of a World Safe for Diversity. This latest work was released just 2 weeks ago by InterVarsity Press. In it, Dr. Guinness calls for a bold reaffirmation of the priority of religious freedom for people of all faiths and none. He implores the United States to transcend its endless and wasteful culture warring and to regain its historic leadership of this issue. Dr. Guinness is a deeply respected author and public intellectual. His insight and perspective on our culture are critically important, and we're honored tonight to host him on our campus. Won't you please join me in offering a warm welcome to our guest, Dr. Oz Guinness.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. That's a warm greeting. We are delighted to have Dr. Guinness, who I will call Oz, with us here on the campus of Baylor University, so welcome. Our C-SPAN viewers as well, we are delighted to pose questions such as the fundamental question that Oz has put before the nation and indeed the entire world, people of good faith: how do we live together with our deepest differences? There are a lot of differences. How can we live together with those differences? How can we live peacefully together? Differences can make us pretty uncomfortable. No matter what our background is, no matter how open-minded we may be, differences can bother us. And we then hear things that we not only don't like, but that we very deeply disagree with. We hear things that make us angry, want us to take action. So how do we live together, since we may disagree vehemently with what we are reading or what we are hearing spoken by a speaker or on the television or social media? We're very concerned about what we're hearing. So how do we live peacefully with those differences? And that is what this wonderful new book, as our provost just put it, is exploring. The call for a global public square, religious freedom, and the making of a world safe for democracy. Join me again in welcoming Oz Guinness.
Thank you again.
Well, to begin the conversation, let me begin with a very flattering review of your book by Professor Thomas Farr of Georgetown, a very renowned leader in the world of religious freedom in his own right. And Professor Farr, in his tribute to your new book, says this: "One of the foremost religious liberty thinkers of our time, Oz Guinness sets forth a soaring goal for this book, establishing a vision of religious freedom, soul freedom, S-O-U-L, soul freedom, that accommodates competing truth claims about who man is and why he exists." Oz, help us understand what you mean by soul freedom.
Well, the term is from Roger Williams. Soul liberty was his great term. And for me, it's the right to reach, to hold, to exercise, to change, and to share what you believe based on the dictates of conscience. Now, that's easy to say, but you can see today all sorts of lesser or false views. For example, there were several American leaders a little while back who talked about freedom of worship, and that's quite inadequate. Every dictator allows freedom of worship. What goes on in your head when your mouth is shut between your two ears? That is not free exercise, as Madison put it out. Or you can see in much of our world today, where religion is despised and dismissed, religious liberty is discounted. So there are many people who say, religious liberty, that's liberty for religious, not for everyone. No, freedom of conscience and thought and religion is for secularist worldviews too. It's for everybody, whether supernatural or naturalistic.
Well, you frequently delve into the history of the American Republic, and in one intriguing treatment of that founding era, you reminded me that in this country we frequently refer to Mr. Jefferson's metaphor in his letter to the Danbury Baptists in 1802 of the wall of separation between church and state. And yet in your book, and this is at page 138, you note that whatever he personally believed, Mr. Jefferson, or did not believe, as the President of the United States, and I'm going to quote, "He was a regular attender at the largest church service in the United States under the roof of the U.S. Capitol. He also invited Baptists and Episcopalians to hold worship services, including Holy Communion in the executive branch buildings." Help us understand this. Take us back in time. Was Mr. Jefferson simply not practicing what he was preaching? Help us. What was Mr. Jefferson up to?
He's much misunderstood today, and people argue about him. But I would say the term, of course, goes back again to Roger Williams. He was the first person to talk of a wall of separation. But as he used it, it was to protect the faith community, not the state. But I think the key thing is that the disestablishment of religion is actually at the heart of the uniqueness of America. But what the founders did was to disestablish the church institutionally, but it never excluded faith from from public life. And that distinctive way of doing it really held until the Everson case in 1947, when you had the idea of strict separation or separationism. In other words, all religion should be excluded from public life today. So you've got the new atheists, say, or strict separationists who are agreeing that we should exclude religion because it's divisive, violent, and so on and so on. Interestingly, the strongest critique of that comes from Europe, which is a much more secular continent, and it comes from atheist philosophers. And the great Jürgen Habermas, he insists to exclude religious voices of any sort is highly illiberal. But sadly, in this country, you've got a number of illiberal liberals who are trying to exclude all religion, and they've distorted Jefferson's view. So, as you said, he went to church, he invited people, the Baptists, Episcopalians, to even have church services in the White House and the Treasury, including communion. And you can't get more specifically sacred than that. So he was not a strict separationist like many of his followers today.
Well, why? Obviously, there would be political reasons for it, but were there other reasons that we know of that Jefferson would say, this is an activity, namely religious worship, that I want to support?
Yes, he does say that. There's a time when he was heading off to church, and Ethan Allen stops him and says, well, why are you going to church, Mr. Jay? You don't believe. And he says, in effect, as the chief magistrate of the land, I want to support something which is so profoundly important. And you can see all the framers would have agreed with that. And you can see it in the Northwest Ordinances and so on. They really understood. In my previous book, I call this the golden triangle of freedom. That freedom requires virtue. Virtue requires faith of some sort, and faith of any sort requires freedom. And like the recycling triangle, it goes round and round. All the framers agreed on that. So you had, say, evangelicals like John Jay and Patrick Henry, Orthodox Christian believers like George Mason, people who are more deists like Jefferson himself, and then freethinkers like Tom Paine. But in terms of the place of faith in public life, there was almost universal agreement.
And what was the value that they saw? You've described the golden triangle. What was the value that the founding generation saw, whether they were believers or skeptics or non-believers?
Well, of course, there was no formal established religion. That's what they denied from the European experience. That was the radical nature of it. But take, say, John Adams. He is openly chary about an entire society of atheists. Freedom of conscience for atheists, absolutely. But a society of atheists, he was chary about, because where would the virtues come from? The grounding of, say, honesty, loyalty, patriotism. What is it that's the highest inspiration of any virtue? What is the most solid teaching of the content of what virtue is? And also, what's a sanction when people are not virtuous? Well, in almost all cases, that's somewhat lacking in a secularist worldview, and it's very strong, for example, in Jewish and Christian worldviews, but not established.
Let's come to the current era, and in your book, and before we go global, this is, after all, the global public square. So there is truly a worldwide perspective that Dr. Guinness is bringing to bear. But you identify in some pretty strong language what you see as violations of soul freedom right here at home in the United States. And one institution that comes in for pretty harsh criticism is Vanderbilt. At pages 101 to 104, you take them to task. Why are you so upset about the Commodores of Vanderbilt?
Well, not just them. And since then, they've been followed by Tufts, and most recently, as you probably followed, the University of California as an entire system. They have, quote, de-recognized religious groups. In other words, they have said that a religious group, not just Christians, but Jews, Muslims, all sorts of religious groups, they cannot have their beliefs as a requirement for membership. So I haven't got the quotation in front of me, but Vanderbilt, for example, when one group asked to be recognized, one of the Christian groups, they had things like the amount of time someone had been in the group and their loyalty to the group and so on. And then among about four criteria, they had an allegiance to Jesus Christ. And the administration sent it back, and that was the only thing they struck out. Well, if you do that, are we going to have Muslims who are members of Hillel societies? And you could go on down the line. If you think of it, it's absolutely absurd, but a very clear violation of people's free exercise to choose as leaders of their group. All the groups welcomed everybody. They welcomed everybody. But as leaders of the group, they did insist that the leaders believed what the group believed. And that's just a simple matter of religious freedom.
The Supreme Court of the United States actually had a case several years ago involving the Hastings Law School, part of the University of California system. So this is an issue that I think the audience will want to be aware of and the implications. And what I'd also like to do is go down to the culture and pick up in the 1980s with Richard John Neuhaus's blockbuster book called The Naked Public Square, the idea of eliminating religious references and religious discourse in the public arena. Get it out of the agora. And in the 1990s, Stephen Carter of the Yale Law School authored a best-selling book called The Culture of Disbelief, and it had a very intriguing subtitle, How American Law and Politics Trivializes Religion. Trivializes. And Professor Carter was arguing that we can preserve separationist values, the separation of church and state, while embracing, not trivializing, the faith of literally millions of Americans. So what is it at work in our culture? What lies behind what's going on these different campuses and more broadly in the culture?
Worldwide, you've got two dueling visions. On the one hand, you've mentioned the naked public square, excluding all religion. And you've got very mild versions of it. The ACLU and Americans United, relatively mild. The French, much more strict, coming out of the French Revolution. Turkey, as it was under Ataturk, would be more like the French system. And then you've got very severe versions of that, say, the Republic of China, where people are oppressed and persecuted and killed for their religious faith, especially Christians and Muslims. Then at the other end, you've got what I call the sacred public square, dueling with the naked public square, where some religion or another is either established or a monopoly, and everyone else to some extent is second class or worse. So about the mildest version of a sacred public square is the Church of England, which in many ways culturally is on its last legs. Then you've got stronger versions, very, very strong ones, like say Iran or Saudi Arabia, where people are at peril with their lives under that system. So Stephen and I would argue for what we call a civil public square, where everybody is free to enter and engage public life, religious, secular, Christian, Jewish, Muslim, Mormon, Scientologist, etc., but within a clear understanding of what is just and free for everybody else too. In other words, a right for one person is a right for another person and a responsibility for both. And so I would argue for this notion of a civil public square over against the sacred public square and over against certainly the naked public square. Why did the latter come in? Well, you've got this mixture of an aggressive secularism. 40 years ago when I was an undergraduate.
It seems like 20 years.
Seems like yesterday. The secularization theory was dominant. In other words, the world gets more modern, the world gets less religious. Now, that's totally wrong factually. Everyone agrees there is an explosion of religion around the world. Religion is furiously alive. But this time, countered by a very aggressive secularism. So the combination between secularism, take, say, Richard Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens, Sam Harris, that type of secularism, combined with a strict separationism, and many of those, for example, some of the Jewish supporters of strict separation, they're not atheists, but because of their experience in Europe, they understandably want something stricter. But that combination of separationism and secularism is very, very powerful now because it's the dominant thing in the American universities, and through the universities in the media. So that's one end of the dual, and I would argue against both extremes. And the other extreme, many of our fellow Christians have often been the extremist in the way they've fought unwisely, and they're creating a backlash against themselves.
And what are some of those movements or examples?
Well, my broad critique of the Christian right is, one, it politicized the faith. By that I mean, they actually followed left wing in the 1920s. They trusted politics to do more than politics can do. Because politics is often downstream from the source of many of the problems, which can't be fixed politically. Newhouse used to say wonderfully, the first thing to say about politics is that politics is not the first thing. It's important, but we can't trust it to do what it can't do. The second thing they've done is more a Christian mistake. To put it in 19th century language, they tried to do the Lord's work, but in the world's way. For instance, Jesus told his followers to love their enemy. And much of the Christian right is known for its stereotyping, its demonizing, and things like this. And sadly, you can see today one of the greatest defections from the Christian faith in all American history among the millennials and many of the younger generation. And they're not just turning against the Christian right, they're turning against the faith itself because they're so turned off by the ugliness that they've seen.
There is an oddity, though, at least in our nation, isn't it? It would seem to me, because of our experience in the civil rights movement not so long ago, in the lifetime of not our students here, but certainly many of our faculty members and staff members, we lived through this. And we remember Dr. King very vividly, not by seeing him in some videotape from yesteryear. We lived with him. We saw him. And we read his letter from the Birmingham jail to his fellow clergy persons. These were deeply Christian narratives that he was lifting up. So why should there be, or why is there, hostility to religion in the public square when it was so efficacious, it would seem, in the civil rights movement? And then when we go back to your own home country, William Wilberforce and the great abolitionist movement of the early 19th century, the great evangelical movement, reform movement, also working on manners, as Wilberforce put it, trying to improve the social lot of the poor in society. In light of that social reform and civil rights reform movements, both in the mother country and here, why should there be any hostility at all?
Let's be frank, it's partly ignorance and partly frank prejudice. For instance, I knew Christopher Hitchens, how religion poisons everything. Well, that's absolute rubbish. And if you look civilizationally, we all know the errors of the church, the Inquisition and so on. But take the gifts of the Christian gospel, the rise of, say, philanthropy, giving, caring, hospices, hospitals, uniquely Western, and it came out of the caring of the church and the parables of Jesus. Or take the reform movements. You mentioned some of the recent ones, but go back to the banning of infanticide. I mean, Romans throwing out unwanted babies in the rubbish dumps in the morning. Christians went out, picked up the babies, and looked after them. And you had Basil of Caesarea with these huge tented cities where the hungry or the orphans or the lepers or whatever, like a sort of shopping mall of people caring for needs of all sorts. And then you have Bartolomeo Las Casas standing against the conquistadores and so on. And then down to the ones you mentioned, like Wilberforce, and you can add all sorts of other people like Elizabeth Fry in prisons. In other words, until the current generation, almost all the great reform movements were inspired by faith in Jesus and by led by people who are openly his followers. Now, it's true today that you have what's called a movement of movements. In other words, you've got secularist groups, you have Muslims groups, you have Buddhist groups, you have all sorts of groups. But it's absolutely ridiculous to ignore the extraordinary role of the church. Take, say, the healthcare mandates. No group in history has done more than the Roman Catholic Church for hospitals. So by cramping them and curtailing their freedom, What they're doing, very simply, anyone who understands civil society, they're killing the goose that lays the golden egg. And now they're trying to do this with foreign policy. And eventually they'll go out, and there's no golden egg in the morning because they've killed off the goose that has done most of this. It's foolish as well as incredibly ignorant.
By the way, a plug for another book, Rodney Stark of the faculty here at Baylor on our Institute for Studies of Religion has written a magnificent book entitled The Triumph of Christianity, and part of the narrative is what was happening in Imperial Rome mm-hmm. with the Christian community coming alongside, treating women with dignity, caring for infants who had been left to die.
And his earlier book, The Rise of Christianity, Plague of Galen and all sorts of things. Now, Rodney Stark has done a huge amount to counteract that ignorance.
Well, let's now, Oz, go global. Religious freedom in the world. You open that door. Let's be clear that you're not simply talking about religious freedom, that throughout the book you make it clear that what you're talking about in terms of soul freedom, building on Roger Williams' great teaching and insight, is freedom of thought, conscience, religion, and belief. So take us on a globe-trotting trip. Anything that you would add to what you said earlier in terms of the state of religious freedom in the world today?
Well, Ken, let me start by saying why it's so urgent. As the world is globalizing and becomes more and more interconnected, many of the huge issues in the environment and technology and the nuclear issues and so on are all coming together. The younger generation are described as the crunch generation in the sense of these converging issues. But underlying many of these other issues, how on earth do we live with our deep differences? And the fact is the explosion of diversity in the world. It's said in my background in sociology, that people say everyone is now everywhere. Well, that's a little exaggerated, but the media, travel, mass movements of people, migration, never has there been such diversity in more parts of the world than there is today. And then you take things like, say, the internet. So a public square was very precious to us as Westerners, going back to the Agora in Athens down below the Acropolis. It was a physical place, the Forum in Rome, the US Congress, Capitol Hill, or Westminster, and so on. But then it shifted from being a physical place to being a metaphor. Op-ed pages in the New York Times, or whatever it is, that was also the public square. But now, and take things like the responses to the Danish cartoons or the Pope's speech at Regensburg. In the age of the internet, even when we're not speaking to the world, we can be heard by the world and the world can organize its response. And so that idea of a public square has become more urgent than ever, and we only need to look around at the oppressions in countries like China or the sectarian violence that we see in the Middle East or, say, Nigeria or Pakistan. This issue is globally urgent. Now, I'm not a Pollyanna. As I see it, you have the United States, which for 2 1/3 centuries has had, Madison called it, the true remedy. I would say as a European, I'm still European, it's the most nearly perfect solution in history. So the framers got race badly wrong at the beginning. They got religious liberty almost nearly right from the beginning. And America's record is better than almost any great country. But 50 years of culture warring since the early Madeleine Murray O'Hare cases, America is squandering her heritage. And not only that, I think, she's failing to be a leader demonstrating how to do it at a time when the whole world wants to know how to do it. Europe's a long way behind, and parts of the world like the Middle East are even further off.
Well, I'm prompted by your comment to remind those of us who admired your earlier book, A Case for Civility. And in that, Oz tells a story of a conversation that you had with the dean of a business school at one of China's most prestigious universities. And the dean, so the Chinese dean, asked you, "What am I missing? We in China are fascinated by the Christian roots of the Western past. In order to see what we can learn for China's future, but you and the West are cutting yourself off from your roots.
Well, we've been discussing things, the distinctive features of the West. I mentioned philanthropy. I mentioned reforms. You could take, say, the rise of the universities, Bologna, Sorbonne, Oxford. You could take the rise of modern science, obviously not science at the beginning, but modern science. And then, of course, the human rights revolution. All of these are distinctive, and many of them indirect or direct gifts of the gospel. They were discussing those. But clearly, our Western civilization, we owe a lot to the Greeks. Philosophy, science, drama, all sorts of things to the Greeks. We owe a great deal to the Romans. And Americans love Rome more than Greece. We in England love the Greeks more than the Romans. But Romans gave us governance. And you can see how Capitol Hill and the Senate, many other things, owe to Rome. But the deepest things of all we owe to the Hebrews. And the whole notion of the understanding of God and his character and ethics, and then humans made in the image of God, and all sorts of things. Now, you can see we are deliberately cutting off those roots. So, when I was a student, I knew Bertrand Russell. People like
Russell. The great philosopher.
Yeah. Great atheist, great secular humanist. He would have argued that you don't need the Christian faith. Humans have dignity. But now you can see, 40-odd years later, many of the leading atheist thinkers are undermining the notion of human dignity. One article, The Stupidity of Dignity. Steven Pinker, The Uselessness of Dignity. So you can see today we are a cut-flower civilization. Now, just one example, you could take the whole notion of freedom itself, let alone religious freedom. But in many of these areas, we're a cut-flower civilization. Or I was just reading a book this afternoon that says, we're living off the whiff of an empty bottle. Hmm. Someone else I read last week, we're living in huge bankruptcy beyond our means. So there will be consequences of a cut flower civilization.
What's the solution? What do we need to do? You're a great diagnostician. Now, what is to be done?
Which of the problems are we talking about?
Well, first of all, buy this book.
let's take religious freedom. That's what the book's about. I hope it will contribute to a reaffirmation of a huge discussion of the primacy of religious freedom. But practically, what can be done? First, America needs to restore civic education. Mm. Everyone outside America understands your motto, A Pluribus Unum, is your greatest achievement. You took amazing diversity and forged one people. But you've got to have both the unum to balance the pluribus. And you can see since the 1960s, there's been a devaluation of civic education. Americanism is coercive, or people have just neglected it. That needs to be restored, because without it, America's increasingly balkanized. I sometimes, with groups of CEOs, business leaders, sometimes churches, sometimes universities, I ask people to put down, give me the top 10 things that are the American unum. Hardly anyone can write down more than two or three. I mean things like the rule of law, equal opportunity, freedom of conscience, things like this. Put all 10 down. They should be true of every American, regardless of the country they come from, regardless of their ethnic background, regardless of their religion. Those are the American unum, and if they're not restored, America's in trouble.
This audience will remember that recently, a little over a year ago, Justice Sandra Day O'Connor was here lifting up that very concern of the collapse of civic education in the United States. And we're very happy at Baylor that Justice O'Connor has anointed us as such to work with the public schools, our Baylor Law School, our School of Education. Dean Engelhardt is here for this gathering to really focus in a very deep way on how we can, in fact, bring back civic education in a very deep and powerful way. Happily, the state of Texas has never abandoned the idea of civic education. We continue to require it in the public schools. And I must also say we're very happy that here at Baylor for 60 years, we have required all undergraduates to take a course in the American constitutional tradition and the rule of law. So what Justice O'Connor and Justice Breyer would call, and I've heard Justice David Souter speak in these apocalyptic terms as well, the collapse of civic education in the United States. So that's one remedial step that we can all work toward taking.
But another area that should be applied, Ken, is immigration. I've lived in D.C. nearly 30 years now. Immigration debate going on, control of borders, English as a second language, economic this, that, and the other. I've never heard a single person in the debate mention civic education. But America needs transmission of values in every generation two ways. One is education, the older generation is the younger generation, public schools. The second is immigration. So when people come in, they know how Americans live, what it means to be American, and so on. It's not just better job opportunities. There's something about being an American that's very important. And Sam Huntington and others have said this, but it's almost lacking in the Washington debate.
We're going to return to the global public square. A gentle reminder that you're invited to enter the Agora and write your questions, which will be picked up, National Press Club style. And what I want to turn to is a recurring theme in your book, Oz, when you talk about the Universal Declaration of Human Rights right after World War II, and I hope you'll provide a little bit of background on that, but you have this recurring rhetorical question. What does it say of us and our times that the Universal Declaration of Human Rights could not be passed today? Could you remind us all, the Universal Declaration, what it means, what it meant, and why you have such a gloomy view about whether it could pass muster today?
I think most human rights people would agree with that. In other words, there was a very interesting convergence of great thinkers like Charles Malik, activists like Eleanor Roosevelt. So these great thinkers and activists did what they did against the backdrop of the world horror of the Nazi death camps. And it was that convergence, people realized the extraordinary degradation, say, of the Jewish people in the Holocaust and so on. Now, we don't have that today. Since then, you can see there was no communist China then, for example. One of the leading thinkers who was behind it was one of the nationalist Chinese. The communists would be opposed to it. Saudi Arabia was the one that sustained, the only one that sustained on the Declaration of Freedom of Conscience. Today, they'd be openly opposed, and almost all the Muslim nations would be openly opposed. Plus the fact, we've got to face the fact that the West has lost its moral authority in the world, and some of its power relative to the rest of the global world. So it's unthinkable that if you did it today. Now, my concern in the book is Article 18. So even you take the beginning of this.
This is freedom of conscience.
Yes. It's a magnificent, simple statement that puts the whole thing. Then you take some of the early, say, the American current administration, some of their early talk, freedom of worship. Absolutely inadequate in the light of Article 18. And of course, Article 18 owes everything to the First Amendment. So just people who are representing America should have known their own heritage, let alone how it's reflected in this great article. So I personally would love to see a reaffirmation of Article 18 and a full I call religious freedom an accordion, like an accordion. You can shut an accordion and you can still call it a musical instrument, it's an accordion. And you can say religious freedom, leave it there. But when you unpack it, just like an accordion coming out, taking all the wind, you get music. And when you say it's the right to reach, hold, practice, share, for example, take, say, a lot of the liberal opposition to proselytism. Well, sharing faith is at the very heart of persuasion. And there's no argument against proselytism that doesn't also undermine liberal persuasion. Or the final one, to change belief. And you can see that's a capital offense in much of the Muslim countries. And we should be standing for these simple but very profound truths in their fullness.
In fact, Article 18 of the Universal Declaration specifically contemplates one's right to change one's religion.
Absolutely.
Which now in some countries would be a capital offense, as you say. Let's move then to your global remedy, which is the Charter, which you had no small hand in drafting. The Global Charter of Conscience, a possible blueprint for living with our deepest differences globally. Tell us about the Charter, which is in the book. It is an appendix to the book, its background and its purpose.
Well, those of us who are behind it are very realistic. It would never be put before the United Nations today. It couldn't, because of the confusion there. So when it was published in Brussels, the UN rapporteur on religious freedom was there, gave an impassioned speech on its behalf, and will lift it any level he can. But very major opponents and lack of, sadly, American leadership on a crucial issue. So what was our hope? We didn't have any utopian hopes that this would sweep the world in 5 minutes. No. It was an attempt again to re-inject a debate about religious freedom, not this wishy-washy stuff that's going on now, a robust, tough-minded debate on religious freedom, and to see it restored to its place as the primary right. So you take the three basic political rights. There's no hierarchy, but freedom of conscience, freedom of speech, and freedom of assembly or association. They're interlocking. But obviously, association assumes and requires speech. You don't want to just to get a kumbaya hugging. But equally, freedom of speech assumes and requires freedom of conscience. You're not there to talk about the weather, although you're free to, of course. You're there to be free to talk about things that matter to you supremely because you're bound by the dictates of your conscience. Now, you all know this is a good Baptist heritage here at Baylor, but sadly, in many parts of the country, it slipped.
Slipping. Professor Tom Farr, who I mentioned at the very outset, makes an argument that political leaders, so now we're not talking about the culture, but the leaders who perhaps are mirroring the culture, are entirely overlooking the need for a global effort or a fight to support religious liberty. And he says this, and he was a career Foreign Service officer and had many diplomatic posts before he entered the academy at Georgetown University. He said, political leaders see religious freedom as an entirely private matter with few legitimate, keyword, public purposes, and in no sense necessary to individuals and societies. Do you agree with what he says? We were talking about the culture,
yeah,
but
no.
Now he's talking about political leaders.
Absolutely agree with Tom on that, absolutely. You could look positively and see how countries that have religious freedom for everybody, it's one of the keys to a thriving, robust civil society. Or you can look at it negatively. Countries that have religious freedom go a long way towards lessening sectarian conflict and violence and so on. So it's an incredibly important factor that goes way, way beyond religion. But the trouble is today that many thinkers in the West are tone deaf. You know, that's Max Weber's term. They simply don't pick up the music. Great sociologist, really the greatest sociologist. Now, Nietzsche himself admits that to think that what you can't hear is therefore not there is what he calls an acoustic illusion. And we all know that dogs and bats and bears can hear things at a frequency we don't. And Weber is saying that many people insist that their secularist worldviews, no God, God's the supernatural, that's all there is. So they're tone deaf. They don't pick up the music by which most people orchestrate their lives. Now you can see sectors of society, and as Tom Farr knows well, one of the most secular parts of America is the State Department. And even Madeleine Albright said that. She said she had 100...
Former Secretary of State.
Distinguished. 100 economic experts, but only one person in the State Department in her day who knew much about religious freedom. And the fact is, it is the primary motivating factor of most of the world. Most of the world is religious, for better or worse. Sam Harris, The End of Faith, that's utopian. That's totally irrational.
What's he saying? That faith is at a dead end?
Yes, and will disappear. Not at all. Anthropologically, sociologically, there's no solid argument for saying that faith will disappear. No. As a follower of Jesus, there are many faiths in the world, some of which I consider have practices that are evil. In other words, the fact they're there doesn't mean we agree with them. But they are there, and that's why freedom of conscience is so important.
I think one of the things that you can help us understand is intolerance. And you quote in the Global Public Square, Lord Patton, chairman of the BBC, chancellor of your alma mater for your DPhil, Oxford. So a rather impressive figure. Mm-hmm. And Chris Patton says,
Former governor of Hong Kong.
It is curious, now this is the chancellor of Oxford, it is curious that atheists have proved to be so intolerant of those who have faith. Why?
Well, back to dear old Roger Williams, who saw so much of this then. He has a wonderful saying that those under the hatches behave differently, he's talking about the ship of state in 17th century terms, those under the hatches behave differently when they're at the helm. In other words, they're aware of all the ways they've been discriminated against and victimized and oppressed, and many of those under the hatches were. But when they're at the helm, they do the same thing themselves, rather than thinking of what is just and free for everybody. And so you can see that happening strongly today. I mean, distinguished member of the current White House talking of, say, homosexual rights, talks of it as a zero-sum game. In other words, any clash with this, anything in its way has to go. Well, that's a kind of militant intolerance, which is odd, because as you know, from John Locke onwards, the Enlightenment tradition has liked the word tolerance. It's actually, I think Roger Williams is right, it's not the best word. Tolerance always has a power equation in it. The majority tolerates the minority. The government tolerates the people. The king tolerates the subject. It has a power equation. Whereas freedom of conscience is inherent as an absolute right in humanness. So freedom of conscience is a far, far better word. But one of the problems of tolerance, it flip-flops into the opposite and very quickly becomes intolerant. And you can think of how political correctness started as inclusive and very tolerant, except for the people they don't tolerate, and they're extremely intolerant. And I think we've got to make people think.
What would the global charter do if it were adopted? And give us a report on what has happened with the global charter that you've been so instrumental in developing.
Well, so far, mainly in European countries. And while I said earlier, America has this incredible tradition of religious freedom, although I would argue you're squandering it today, Europe has a completely different problem. Many of the seeds of the best principles are there back in history, but they never flowered in Europe. So Roger Williams, an Englishman, founder of Rhode Island, it flourished here, sadly, not back in England. Now, if you look at Europe today, the trouble is Europe is thick. Forgive me, Ken, as a distinguished lawyer and a judge, Europe is thick with laws, articles, conventions, laws everywhere. But as great European thinkers like Montesquieu or, say, Tocqueville pointed out, you need not only law, Tocqueville said, you need the habit of heart.
That's a great term. Could you repeat it?
You need not only law, you need the habits of the heart.
Habits of the heart.
And he gets that from Montesquieu, who said you not only need the structures of law, you need the spirit of liberty in every generation. Now, in Europe today, the gap between all these incredible laws and the average person is total. They haven't a clue what religious freedom means, including, sadly, many of the leaders in Brussels and the leaders in my own country, England. So the gap between these highfalutin laws and the way people actually practice is extreme. So in Europe, we're trying to launch a discussion It's got to get down to the habits of the heart, civic education again, parents to children, teachers to students, etc. It's got to become a living spirit in every generation, or it just won't work.
Learned Hahn, a great American judge of the 20th century, wrote a small book really based on a speech that he gave to celebrate the 4th of July and what American liberty meant, and he simply called it The Spirit of Liberty, just as Montesquieu's great work was The Spirit of the Laws, not just the text, but the spirit of the laws. I've had several people during the course of the day, including at a reception just a little while ago, talk to me about the Middle East. In light of, and each day brings news, today was no exception, of what is unfolding in the Middle East, Egypt, Syria is on everyone's lips. The Pew Research Center has reported that the world's highest levels of government restrictions on religious beliefs and practices are found in the Middle East and North Africa. And one of the issues now before the President of the United States, the Congress of the United States, the American people is, what should we be doing in that part of the world? Would you like to share with us if you have views on, I realize you're not a foreign policy buff, but as a European observer of America, what should we be doing in that part of the world?
Well, let me back up a bit.
Okay.
I quote somewhere in one of the books the famous remark of Bismarck, supposedly when he was dying, he was asked, what would be the decisive factor for the 20th century? And he died in 1898, I believe. And he said, surprising his friend, the fact that Americans speak English. That would be the decisive factor in the 20th century. And he was right. Now, you ask today, what's...
What did he mean by that?
Well, what he meant by that was the world power then was Britain, and within 20 years had declined and faded. And the vacuum was filled not by the victor of some European conflict, Germany, France, or whatever, but by the United States and what became the American century. Now, if you ask today, there's no one factor for the 21st, but a lot of people would argue there are three vital factors, and what's interesting to me is they all touch on religion. So the first one is the one you're raising. Can and will Islam modernize peacefully? I'll come back to that. The second great one, which faith will replace Marxism in China? Mm. Everyone in China knows the party's in power, the ideology is hollow. Will it be nationalism, materialism, Confucianism, authoritarianism, Buddhism? Or I've heard it argued in the Chinese Academy, it could in 20 years' time be the Christian faith as the majority faith in China. Enormously significant, which for the world and for China. But the third faith is the one you touched on earlier, a question, the one we touched on earlier. Will the West sever or recover its roots? Now, pick up the first one again. What's happening, as I understand it, is that you see Islam engaging with modernity. And it's brought out the challenge of Sunni and Shia and more modernizers and more Salafis trenching and so on, and probably for next 20, 30 years, the Middle East will be a convulsion of this Islamic reaction to modernity. Now, the fact is, the 20th century showed that we Brits and the French across the Channel did a lousy job understanding the Middle East, and we understand it a lot better than many American diplomats understand it. So you've got to stick into the hornet's nest with great care. And you can see a lot of my American friends in Washington didn't even know where Iraq was until George W. declared war on it. And you saw it every night on the map, and so on. So I think we need a much, much greater understanding of Islam, of Middle Eastern culture, and of what this engagement with modernity is likely to be, and how little, comparatively, we can do to shape it in strong ways.
Reflections on Syria and what the U.S. should do?
Well, again, to go back, if the reports are right, I think the president made a huge mistake in his Cairo speech to insist that the Muslim Brotherhood were invited to the front row, and the leadership of the country refused to come because of that. In other words, there was an incredibly naive view of the power of Islam in that speech and in the whole policy towards Islam since then. And not surprisingly, when it came, as we saw, Morsi won the democratic election and caused the problems that have come there. Now, when you come to Syria, maybe when Kofi Annan had tried so hard 2 years ago, that's when we should have put our shoulder behind his efforts. We didn't. And now it's got to the place he does nothing, he looks weak. If he does something, he'd probably look rash. Maybe Kerry's offhand remark and the Russians have got him off the hook. I don't know. Personally, I was opposed to a strike for the sort of reasons that I mentioned.
Would you join me in saying thank you to Oz Guinness, who now... Thank you. Invites questions from the audience. Again, this is National Press Club, Washington, D.C. style, and the provost is here to pose the questions that you, in turn, or to report the questions that you're posing for our distinguished guest.
Okay, our first. In the era where complicated, serious issues are reduced to sound bites on which arguments are premised, how do we move towards a modern public agora that can deal with these issues?
Great question, because the technological factors exacerbating the incivility are enormous. You take, say, sound bites, or you take, say, direct mail. Studies have shown you put 20 letters of direct mail in front of it, and just examine the words underlined in red or green. They're almost always appealing to near hatred or fear or whatever. Or you take something like the blogs, where you have anonymous screen names, and wherever you have that anonymity, the blogs very quickly descend to a sort of barbaric discourse. So again, civic education today really has to work overtime to restore civility and show people what debate with respect really means. Now, those of us who are Christians, we're told to speak the truth with love, with respect, with grace, etc., etc. So that should underlie everything that we contribute in the public square. But it's a massive problem.
Well, speaking of modern agora and our National Press Club, I got a question on my phone, so I thought I would read that one. What encouragement would you give pastors for involvement in the protection of religious liberty for everyone?
Well, those of you Baptist pastors, you have a great tradition in this area. But I would say, start like this. If you look at Alexis de Tocqueville in the 1830s, he says, on the one hand, that religion is the first of the American institutions. It is that decisive. But he also shows how pastors didn't preach politics from the pulpit. In other words, they preached the scriptures, but their influence was indirect from the bottom up, and their lay people went out and lived in society, and it was influential. So with the rise of the Christian right, the pulpit has often been politicized, with pastors telling their people how to vote and so on. That is a sign of weakness, not of strength. So pastors should unashamedly preach the scriptures, the entire word of God, and encourage their lay people to live it out in every inch of their lives, including, since we're in an open, free, democratic republic, as voters. So it's an enormous shame that so many evangelicals, for example, simply don't vote. That is a crying shame on them. But I'm not suggesting the pastors politicize their sermons. No, preach the scriptures and trust the lay people to live it out in the whole of their lives.
Very good. What is the prospect for expanded religious liberty in China?
I go back to China every couple of years. I'll be back there in a couple of weeks. And I often speak on religious liberty because China knows They have incredible diversity, but how do they achieve harmony? So Hu Jintao, the president, says, we are a harmonious society. And I say to people who quote that, yes, you have diversity, you have harmony, but you don't have what it takes, which is liberty, diversity, liberty, and still have harmony. And for that, you need religious freedom. Now, everyone knows in China that the Communist Party is sort of trying to keep the lid on the pot, which is boiling. And the influence of free market capitalism and the influence of cell phones and technology are bringing in all sorts of impulses towards freedom, which they have to recognize. They want to let steam off here, but still keep their control. And one of the ways they're going to have to face is they need to introduce religious freedom. Now, that undermines the way they have conducted things, and you have a country that's killed more of its citizens than any country in the whole of history. So it'll be a tough thing, but there are a number of voices beginning to raise religious freedom in China, the way that you have a number of Muslim voices raising it in the Middle East. I won't mention the country, but I was talking to a Muslim leader recently who'd written a book on freedom of conscience, which he had published anonymously, pseudonymously, in another Muslim country where he was free to do so, hoping the book would go back to his own country. And it's dangerous for them at the moment. But hopefully, as people like that speak and we reinforce and support them, freedom of conscience will spread.
Tomorrow is the 12th anniversary of the September 11th attacks. What has been the lasting impact of these attacks on the community of faith?
You could look at it in all sorts of areas. I thought you were going to ask me the community as a whole. On the community of faith, sadly, it's given people the view of religion as negative, religion tied in with terrorism and so on, rather than people, in other words, it's fed the kind of Christopher Hitchens, how religion poisons everything, that type of argument. It has given many in this country an alarmist view of Islam. There is a huge difference between Islam and Islamism and Salafism and so on. And it's a simple fact that when Muslims are a minority in a situation where the majority is different, the great majority of them go along with the ways of the country, whether it's the United States or France. And much of the Christian fear and alarmism is not only unchristian. Our Lord keeps saying, have no fear. The Bible says that a million times, have no fear. You can see that 9/11 created a huge sense of fear and alarmism in the Christian community, which has stopped the natural impulse to love them, reach out to them, share the faith with them, and so on. So there are all sorts of implications. Obviously, one of the main implications we're seeing in the last year, freedom always undermines itself three ways. One, it becomes permissiveness and license. Two, and this is the one that's happened since 9/11, freedom-loving people love security and safety, so they have so much security, they lose freedom. Think of what the NSA is following now. And the third is that freedom-loving people value freedom so much, they'll fight for it in any way because it's the supreme value, even in ways that contradict freedom. And sadly, we've had examples of all three of those since 9/11.
Here's the last question we have. What contribution can faith-based higher educational institutions, like Baylor, make to the creation of the global public square?
Baylor comes out of a great tradition of a Baptist understanding and commitment to religious freedom, which is so important. So you can be naturally in the forefront of this as one of the most significant universities in the country, as well as people who have a natural affinity for religious freedom. So I hope, Baylor is doing it. And I just think of many of your distinguished professors who've made an extraordinary contribution in this area. It's invidious for me to roll off names, but you're already doing it. But it might be worth thinking of the whole notion, put it like this. I wrote the book, this one, because there are masses of good academic studies, no shortage of academic studies. Always have more, but there's no shortage. And we've got hundreds of good activists and others who are standing against oppression, persecution, etc. around the world. There's no shortage of either academic studies or people standing against it. Where we're missing is a constructive vision of a better way. Now, America needs that in a whole lot of areas. The conservative movement at large is largely reactionary and has no powerful constructive vision of a way forward. And so Baylor, I think, could be part of showing what such a vision should be. And you're ideally poised with your academic credentials and your great heritage of religious freedom to make such a contribution.
A constructive vision of a better way. That's what Dr. Oz Guinness, born in China, living his life both in the UK and now for the last 30 years in the United States. And his call has been for both sides of the Atlantic and now for the entire globe to come to terms with living with our deepest differences. A lot of us learned at our mother's or father's knees the golden rule, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And one of the things that Oz is saying in this very important book to all of us is we need to respect one another and to respect these different voices and to welcome these different voices into the conversation. And this is nothing new, it's millennia old, but it's as if much of the world has either forgotten or chooses to ignore. This way of getting along in a world filled increasingly with deep differences that are so abundantly manifested by virtue of our ability to communicate and to travel. And so I close by saying what we've heard tonight from this great voice of Dr. Oz Guinness echoes what Tertullian wrote in the year 212, not 2012, 212. It is a fundamental human right that every man, we would say person, should worship according to his own convictions. You have broadened that to conscience, not just worship. Or John Jay, the great founder to whom Oz referred early on in the conversation, to contend for our own liberty, but to deny that blessing to others, involves an inconsistency not to be excused, an inexcusable inconsistency. And later this year, collaboratively with Georgetown University, Baylor University will be participating in a global conference in Rome that will mark the fact that the Emperor Constantine in the year 313 declared as a matter of imperial law that every person in the empire should have the right to freedom of conscience. So we begin with Roger Williams, we move all the way to what's unfolding in the Middle East. We return to ancient texts and to great, great enduring values so that we can look ahead in the 21st century to a true global public square. Join me in thanking Dr. Oz Guinness.
Thank you. Thank you. Great. Thank you.